Okay, the rather informal structure here is that each of the panelists is going to say a few words, around 5 minutes. There will be an opportunity for the panelists to react to one another. We'll have a discussion of the issues. And then we'll throw the floor open to you folks for questions and comments. Tom Chun is going to begin. He graduated from Harvard Law School in 1966 and the Stanford Graduate School of Business in 68. He's been in the high-tech world since 1976, has been the CEO of several startups, a successful businessman in the high-tech world. Tom.
I go first?
You go first.
So I feel like the warm-up act for the headliners, but I think I'll take the bait. Although the topic is key domestic issues facing the country, I think I'm actually going to avoid that at the beginning because I think there's so many issues out there in economic, political, cultural, social, civic spheres that we ought to go up a couple levels and first of all decide how do we decide which domestic issues are key. In my case, I draw on my experience. One leg is from the EU, and one is from Silicon Valley. The reason I mention the EU is I happened to be in France in the summer of 2005, about a month after France rejected the EU Constitution, which was a shock, I think, to the bureaucrats in Brussels. So I took the opportunity to conduct an informal poll in French with my friends, colleagues, acquaintances about what happened. The question that sticks in my mind, and the answers actually, which stick in my mind, had to do with what is the European dream? Surprisingly, although all of the people I talked to knew what le rêve américain was, no one knew what the European dream was. And I think that lack of aspiration, that lack of hope is in part part of the problem of the EU. In our case, when you think about it, I guess to quote Margaret Thatcher said that Europe was created by history, America was created by philosophy. And I think our philosophy was set out in part in the Declaration of Independence, which is really the foundation for the American dream. And I think the American dream of upward mobility, and in fact, is one of the distinctive traits of the United States. There was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal where engineering students at Stanford were polled and compared to three Chinese universities, Tsinghua, Peking University, and Beijing Normal. And interestingly enough, the Stanford engineering students, of those, 22% wanted to start or join a startup company, and only 5% wanted to work for the government. By contrast, at the three Chinese universities, and these are among the elite universities in China, just 3% wanted to join startups, but 52% wanted to join the government. So I think that shows the strength of the American dream, which still survives, but I think is, in fact, under attack in this country. The other leg of my framework, I don't want to speak too long, is Silicon Valley. When I got into the computer industry back in the late 70s, the dominant narrative was that great companies were built by sharp people with great ideas, like Bill Gates out of Microsoft, like Steve Jobs out of Apple, or even Yale's Mitch Kapoor, who started Lotus Development and Lotus 1-2-3. But the facts really didn't support that. If you looked at the dominant computer industry of the 70s and even today, they're number 19 in the Fortune 500. It was IBM. And they left so many companies in the dust that the industry structure was called IBM and the Bunch. The also-rans were Burroughs, Univac, NCR, Control Data, and Honeywell. And even before that, two other companies which were no slouches, GE and RCA, were in the computer industry. And then it was called IBM and the Seven Dwarfs. So, to test the Silicon Valley narrative, if a great guy was going to be able to run this great company and build it into a major force, how could you do it at IBM, which had 340,000 employees at the time? Statistically normal distribution would say that IBM's employees were no better, no smarter, no more talented than the employees at the other large companies with whom they competed. So it seems to me that the key factors really go into the soft side, not the hardware of humans, but the software of culture and values, training and selection, and processes and policies of management. So if you apply that to the United States has 315 million residents. It's almost impossible to say that because of statistically normal distribution that the United States has better people, smarter people, than its global competitors. So again, I would apply those three factors, culture and values, training and selection, which is really done by our educational establishment, and government policies and processes to see whether, in fact, to identify those issues which are key factors facing the country. With that framework, I'm just going to touch on a couple possible issues and open it up, of course, at some point to discussion from the audience. In terms of American culture and values, there was an interesting book written a couple years ago by Charles Murray, Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010. And he contended that the founding virtues of the country, which he defined as honesty, industriousness, marriage, and religiosity, were in fact no longer shared by the entire population. They were still, despite the 60s, embraced by what he called the upper middle class. But the working class in this country had abandoned those values. Honesty was an issue because so many people were arrested or incarcerated in the blue-collar working class. Industriousness was an issue because so many people had left the workforce. They were on welfare, they were on disability, they weren't even looking for a job, and some of them, of course, were surviving on crime, which is why honesty was an issue. Marriage was an issue because so many people got married, particularly women got married, but after they had kids, and they often married someone who was not the biological father of their children. And religiosity was important because this is where virtues were taught, and the founding fathers felt that virtue was important to the success of a free country. And it was also, according to Murray, there's a high correlation between those who go to religious services and those who volunteer for civic projects and other civic organizations. From the leadership training and selection side, I think it's pretty obvious that our schools are failing. Albert Schenker, who was head of the United Federation of Teachers and the American Federation of Teachers, described the public schools' mission as they were largely to help mostly immigrant children learn the three R's and what it means to be an American, with the hope that they would go home and teach their parents the principles and the Constitution and the Declaration that unite us. And as for those of you who follow education, in terms of the three R's, there's a periodic testing through the National Assessment of Educational Progress. In 2009, only 26% of 12th graders were considered proficient in mathematics, and only 38% were proficient in reading. With respect to U.S. history, which is presumably where citizens learn about the Constitution and the Declaration, only 12% of 12th graders were proficient. By contrast, if you look at other countries, there are a number of international comparisons. The OECD has something called PISA, which is the Program for International Student Assessment. We typically follow consistently many of the Asian countries, such as China, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong. So despite all the money that we've added to the education system, we haven't really made a lot of progress. With respect to universities, my personal feeling is that political correctness is a crippling blow. Once you get out of high school and apply to college, students find that whites have to score 310 points higher in the SATs than blacks to get in. Asians have to score 450 points higher to get in. And this is on a 1,600-point SAT scale. That's a pretty significant barrier. As an example of the political correctness that impacts college admissions, I point to Yale's admission of Syed Rumatullah Hashemi in 2005, when we were at war in Afghanistan with the Taliban. Hashemi was the Taliban ambassador at large. He had never graduated from high school, and Yale welcomed him with open arms. To me, that can only be understood in terms of political correctness. What would it be in a country where the American dream still lived. Well, you can look at California, surprisingly. California has a law against using ethnicity and race in college admissions. At UC Berkeley, the admitted class is 40% Asian. Caltech, which does not use ethnicity or race, it's 40%. Stanford, which is the most select college in the country, based on 2013 statistics with a 5.69% admit rate, has 23% Asians. Whites, by the way, are 36%. In the Ivy League, home of Syed Rumatullah Hashemi, all eight schools cluster around 16% the admission of Asians, plus or minus. Now, I don't mean to argue for Asians because I happen to be one. My point is that Asians are the ones who score the highest. They come from the cultures that beat us on these international tests, and yet we turn them down. I think Dean Howe yesterday claimed there are no quotas at Yale. I question that. So finally, I get to government policies, and I think I'm going over, so I'm going to go a little faster. The government policies and processes, I think the American dream is really based on this idea that irrespective of your social class and circumstances of birth, with hard work, determination, you can achieve a better life for yourself and your family. We have an administration now that tells people who embrace the American dream that you didn't build that. They are, that the fairness requires that your success be redistributed to those that the administration feels are more deserving. That there is scapegoating of the so-called 1%, even though they pay 37% of all federal income taxes, and the bottom 49% pays zip. At this time, according to the Tax Foundation, 60% of Americans receive more in benefits than they pay in taxes. As we all know from learning, studying economics here at Yale 50 years ago, Keynesian economics teaches you that economic growth is correlated with investment. By redistributing from the 1%, you take assets from those with the highest propensity to save and give it to those with the highest propensity to consume. That's no way to grow the economy. And finally, when you give taxpayer funds to cronies, you starve those projects which have the greatest economic return, and in turn fund those projects with the greatest political return, be it contributions or votes. So to quote Margaret Thatcher once again, this concept of fairness is, in her mind, something that the honorable gentleman is saying that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich. Thank you.
Let me check again on the acoustics. Was that okay? Could everybody hear and understand? Good.
Couldn't hear.
We don't know what he said.
David was saying we couldn't hear him up here, so we have no idea what he said.
I could hear him.
You all seem to be attentive, so that's good. David Boren has spent 28 years in elective office, first in the state legislature, then as governor of Oklahoma in the U.S. Senate representing Oklahoma, and now for 19 years as the president of the University of Oklahoma, and is waiting eagerly for our current president, Rick Levin, to step down, because as soon as he does, President Boren will be the longest serving university president in the country.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There really has been no coup d'etat against Rick. I want to stress that. Can you hear me all right, or is this okay? Right there, okay. I'll keep it right there. I'm just going to try to forget my earlier political experience, which is the art of the filibuster, which is have absolutely nothing to say but take as long as possible to say it. And you've all seen that honed to a fine art in watching C-SPAN. So I'll just go directly to just a few points that I hope we'll come back to. One, since I went back to the University of Oklahoma to become president, one of the things I've done is I have taught the freshman government class every single semester, so now for 38 straight semesters. And one of the things that I wanted to find out when I first started is, how do my students view this country? How do they view our government? What do they know of our history, as Tom has said? compared to the way we felt. So I went back and I found some polling data that covered our years at Yale, and according to the polling data at that time, 84% of the American people trusted their government. They were focused on the federal government, the president, their Congress, et cetera, to do the right thing and to represent people like them, 84%. By the 1980s, that number had fallen down into the 40 percentile range. And at the last polling data, the students I'm teaching today, that number is now at 8%. So you think about how we felt about our government, how we felt that it represented us, how we felt that it listened to us, how we felt that it honorably dealt with the issues of the day, and there has been a dramatic disconnect between the people and our government. That, to me, is one of the most dangerous developments. It's even perhaps this, and a feeling of helplessness to do anything about it. So that, to me, is of deep concern as we look at all of, and how we can re-knit the fabric of our society as we talk about going forward. What are some of the things that I think we ought to think about? One, this is entitled domestic issues. I don't think you can separate domestic issues from foreign policy issues. And the one thing I kind of kept my hand in, I continued until last week when I finally said, I have a day job, I can't keep doing this, to co-chair the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, which gets another set of nonpartisan. It was created by Eisenhower, a whole group of nonpartisan people to look at what we're doing with foreign policy and national security. But, you know, Professor Kennedy at Yale, in his great book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, pointed out something we have to think about. We'll have no funds, we'll have no resources, no ability to rebuild our strength domestically if we overstretch ourselves globally in terms of our foreign policy. And that's something I think we really have to worry about. The most dramatic example to me is between the two presidents, Bush. Under the administration of President Bush Sr., we were, of course, involved in a Gulf War. I was chairing the Intelligence Committee at that time. I knew exactly from day to day how much other countries were sharing. We had a true coalition. Interestingly enough, the forces at the front lines were Islamic, from Islamic countries, so we did not make it a war between the East and the West, so to speak, or between two religions. The other countries that could not participate, and even some that did, participated financially. So finally, when it was over with, we had a foreign policy of partnership in a very dangerous and expensive operation, the first Gulf War. And I think many of you know what the cost to the American taxpayers of the first Gulf War was. Zero. Zero. Japan, for example, contributed a very large amount. They couldn't send troops. They contributed so much that when it was all over with, they had contributed $28 million more than they owed us to get the American taxpayers to zero. We were honorable enough to return the $28 million to Japan. Now compare the second Gulf War, which was basically the attitude of we, the superpower, will undertake leading the world by ourselves, bearing the costs, bearing the burdens. We're over $2 trillion in counting as we continue to wind down in Afghanistan after Iraq, and we also are trying to count all the costs of dealing with those with injuries, physical, emotional problems, and other things as they return home. All I'm saying is, without getting into that, that's a whole different argument. We cannot detach what we do in foreign policy, and we must realize we are a country of no longer unlimited resources. We no longer have all the 10 largest banks in the world. Our share of the world gross national product has been shrinking 1% a year for about 15 years in a row. So we have to be very, very careful in terms of realizing that we're a nation of limited resources. Now let me turn to something, and you might expect this to be of concern to me, but something's happening in this country without any debate about it. Let's think about things. We have to think about how do we keep this country strong? How do we keep this country vital? We're 5.5% of the world's population. 5.5% of the world's population. We have other countries, China, India, and others, who at least in gross terms, not they haven't yet caught us in per capita income, but they're growing at a rate that's much more rapid than ours. How do we small 5.5% of the world's population with, I think, very strongly, with the right values, with the values that the kind of what we really want to present in our country is opportunity, that's the essence of human dignity, to be able to live out your full potential yourself and have the energy and effort to do it. I agree with Tom about that. How do we assure that? We clearly must be the best educated people in the world if we're going to do that. There's one area, one great asset this country has. We are still ahead of all the other nations in the world by far in the number of the greatest institutions of higher education in the country. And why are our students thinking about not just getting a job, be it with the government or someone else, but even creating their own jobs? It's because we have been in a system of higher education that has encouraged creativity, debate, independent thought, and not just rote learning. And so where are all the people in the world trying to come to the university? Here in the United States. But what are we doing? Without any debate, we are abolishing public higher education in the United States. We're abolishing it. And let me say how, and we're not debating it. We didn't have any real public higher education in this country until the Morrill Act after the Civil War, the end of the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln. Now we had some, very little. In 1800, there were 5 million people in the United States. And guess how many people were at colleges and universities out of that 5 million? 1,050. 1,050. Places like Yale and so on. By the time that today, by the way, that figure is about 26 million in public institutions of higher education. What happened, we know, when we greatly expanded the opportunity for people to have higher education. And we're very concerned. I am worried about the middle class. Now, how we got there, I don't know. Tom and I might have some differences of opinion on how we got there. But one thing is sure. Rather than give handouts or even try to do it all with tax policy or something else, I think the greatest thing you can do to assure equality of opportunity in this country is to assure equality of opportunity, of equal educational opportunity, the opportunity to access great schools. That's the single most important thing for equality of opportunity. And here's what's happening. At the end of World War II, we all know what happened. We had a 500% increase through the GI Bill in the number of people going on to higher education in this country. And during that period of time, in a little over 20 years, we doubled the real incomes of Americans, the real incomes of Americans. At the rate of our current economic growth, it will take 2,800 years to double the real purchasing power, I'm serious, and incomes of American families. So if you want a trace and you want evidence for the fact that exposing more Americans to higher educational opportunity of high quality increased our economic competitiveness, it increased the size and stability of the middle class in this country and helped it grow, and now we are going in the absolute opposite direction. Why do I say that? I'll just take my state as an example. When there was enlightened governorship in our state, you can guess those years, the budget of the University of Oklahoma, 60% of it came from the state. And this can apply to whether you're in Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Carolina, wherever state you're from. It's about 60%. When I came back and left the Senate and resigned 2 years early to go back into higher education, we were down to 36% was coming from the state. There's no causal relationship here with my presidency. This year it was 14%. 14% came from the state. What percentage, and by the way, our medical school, 6% from the state. Is that a public medical school or is that a private medical school that occasionally gets a little gift from the state? University of Virginia, some of you are probably Virginians, we're down to 3 or 4% of the total state budget for the University of Virginia is from the state. Is it a public university or is it a private university? We're down to 14% and 6% for the medical. Are we public? At what point do we cross the lines and no longer are we a public university? It's all over the United States. In about 46 states, you will find that those ratios have changed by about the same amount as Oklahoma. Where's the cost come from? Well, we know. Some of it are lucky enough that our research has gone up. Some of us are lucky enough that our private donations have gone up. But 75% of that cost has been changed exactly from the state and handed over to the individual students and their families. What has been the result? Last time I talked to Bob Gates, the last day he was Secretary of Defense, I happened to be over at the Pentagon, and I said, well, Bob, as you're leaving the office, there were just the two of us there, I said, what's your greatest concern? I expected him to talk about military programs or gaps in our preparedness in a certain area. He said, my greatest concern is that as a small nation, literally, with the population of the world, and trying to extend our influence, our values, and all the rest of it, we have dropped from first place in the world 10 years ago. First place in the world 10 years ago in the percentage of our college-age young people that are going on to some kind of higher education to 12th in just 10 years or less. Now, what does that do to our competitiveness? What does that do to our ability to assert world leadership when we are doing that? We've talked a little bit, we heard a little bit about public schools, it's the same thing. If you take the top five nations in the world in their verbal and mathematics scores of the various kinds that Tom was citing, you'll find that one thing's the same in all those five countries. One Finland, one Singapore, they're all over the globe, but one thing they have in common, their teachers, 80% of their teachers graduated in the top 25% of their college classes. In the United States, 80% of our teachers in public schools have graduated from the bottom half of their classes in public schools. Why? I had a big group like this of our students, our brightest freshmen. I said, how many of you would really love being teachers? Half the hands went up. I said, how many of you are planning to be teachers? Maybe 4% of the hands stayed up. And I said, why? They said, we can't feed our families. We cannot provide the opportunities we want for our families. We cannot have the help. In those five countries, the actual salaries in real terms are twice as high as they are for public school teachers in the United States. So I worry about that. I worry, and this opens a whole other can of worms that I hope David will probably get into more. Our government is totally dysfunctional. And we as a people, again, of limited resources, cannot afford less than optimal solutions, whether like a health care bill. Can we afford to continue to pay 60-70% more than the other developed countries in the world for our health care? Can we afford a bill that looks like a camel that was written by a committee? And how did it get there? Because neither party would compromise with the other. And also because we still have the arcane filibuster in the Senate. So to get those last 10 votes to pass anything, you have to do all sorts of crazy things that make sure a system will not work. So we don't have optimal solutions. So I just stop there. We're encouraging more polarization by the way we district our congressional districts. We make them all safe Democratic or all safe Republican. The number of landslide districts in elections has tripled in the last 20 years, and what does that mean? If David's running in a safe Republican district, he does not have to worry about getting along with Democrats or moderates or independents. People he has to please are the far, far extremists in his own party. If I'm running in a safe Democratic district, I have the same thing to worry about. Only the most extreme people on the left. And then if we try to get together to solve a problem, like write a sensical health care bill that might actually do something about bringing better care at lower cost, we're both pilloried and we both get opponents in our primaries and probably we'll both get defeated, because we're in districts that have been redistricted in a way that penalize the people who are trying to get together and make things happen and form a consensus in the country. Political consensus is not a bad word. Political consensus is something the country desperately needs, because we cannot afford how many or how little taxes we pay a government that is totally dysfunctional. Okay, those are just some of the things that I worry about.
David Gergen is professor of public service and co-director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Kennedy School at Harvard University. He is, as you all know, because you've seen him on television, senior political analyst for CNN. He has been White House advisor for four presidents. attesting to the bipartisanship that was hoped for by David Warren. Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He served on many nonprofit boards, including Duke University and Yale University. He has 25 honorary degrees, and his assistant, when he emailed me this information today, said he thinks that that is 24 more than he deserves. Left unspecified was the one he thought he earned.
Thanks, Avi. Good afternoon. It's good to see all of you. I don't know about you, but after listening to Tom and David, I think we should open the bar. Wow. David is, I must say, we're all extraordinarily proud of David Boren and what he's contributed to public life. He's not only been a wonderful president,
I'll tell you later.
Yeah. He was a great governor, too, and that can't be said of all governors. I was in Illinois recently, and somebody was recounting a conversation in prison, and one of the prisoners said to the other one, he said, "You know, the food was a lot better in here when you were governor." David escaped all that. Well, I don't know about you all, but I looking out across this crowd, we've all grown just a touch older. My wife has heard me say this, but I've gotten to the stage in life where I'm very sympathetic with an old fellow who was walking through the woods one day, and he heard this sound, and he couldn't see anything, and then he heard it again, looked down, and there was a frog by the side of the path. And the frog looked up at him and said, "If you kiss me, I'll turn into a beautiful princess." He thought, "All right, that's terrific." Reached down, scoops up the frog, puts it in his pocket. No kiss. Well, the frog's very surprised, crawls up his jacket. "Didn't you hear me? If you kiss me, I'll turn into a beautiful princess." "Yeah, I heard you all right, but at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog." And that's about where I am. And there are a lot of frogs in politics these days, David, I'll tell you that. Now, let me ask you for a show of hands. I'm curious of how many of you think we're leaving a better world to our children than we inherited 50 years ago, or how many of you think we're leaving a worse country, a better country or a worse country to our kids 50 years later? How many of you think we're leaving a better country than 50 years ago? There are a few brave souls. That's interesting. How many of you think we're leaving a worse country? That says it all, doesn't it? That's about where we are. I will tell you, I do think there are some things that are better, and that we should take some pride as a generation. And one is that the doors of opportunity have swung open much more than they were when we were undergraduates for women, for blacks, for other minorities, for Latinos, and that's a good thing. Not as many have been able to go through that door for a variety of reasons, but at least, you know, I think one of the great things we missed as undergraduates was more women on campus who could legally stay here overnight. You know? And so I think that's been a big, big plus. I think David Boren contributed enormously to something else, and that was, this is a much safer world than when we graduated in 1963. We remember we went through the Cuban Missile Crisis as a class. Some of us thought we'd have to go to Canada. And it's a safer world because we built the strongest military, and even though we've made egregious mistakes, as in Iraq, by and large, we have been a benevolent force in the world, and there were a lot of our classmates who went to Vietnam to make that happen. And we ought to be grateful to them because I think they have made this a safer place, even though many of them paid a price, and paid a serious price. I do think that we remain the most innovative country in the world. We're more innovative today than we were before. Tom knows this so well from his own experiences. It's what distinguishes us. We are, and I think it's in our DNA, you know, that we send people to China and India to learn how, to see how they teach their children to learn by rote. They send their folks here to see how we are so creative. And that's something that's really distinguished us for a long time. And as David Boren said, We remain, and we do have the best universities in the world. They're catching up on us. China is coming fast. And by the way, Stanford's coming very fast. But we do have the best universities in the world. So I think all that is terrific, and we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that some things have gone right and that our generation has contributed to that degree. But I think it's also true that many of us share a sense of guilt that our generation has done so poorly on dealing with some of the issues that remain and that we're letting our kids inherit. And if you look at Rick Levin's baccalaureate speech, his last speech as president, he really says, you know what, to the next generation, we, the older generation, we're basically screwing you guys. We're putting ourselves in a privileged position at the expense of a lot of people who are coming after us. And that, you can look at a variety of things the education people have covered. When we graduated from here in 1963, the U.S. was number one in the world in K-12 education. Number one in the world in K-12 education. You had the best universities. Today in OECD, we're 15th, 17th, 18th, 20th, take your choice, out of 35 countries, and that doesn't even count Shanghai, Hong Kong, or Singapore. And that is an indictment of what we're doing, what we've done in education. The entitlement reform, getting his budget under control, it's been striking to me that Bob Gates and Mike Mullen, who is the outgoing chief of staff of the Joint Chief, both share a perspective that the main threats to our national security are not China, they're not Iran, they're not North Korea, they're here at home, and in Mullen's view, it's the national debt. It's the number one threat to our well-being and our security as a country, and that's something we have not addressed. I think we've got cultural issues that need to be discussed more openly and more frankly than we are. Because it's not simply a question of how do we get more kids to have an incentive to go to college? How do we make sure that scholarships are available to them? The other big question is, how do you get them ready for college? Yeah. You know, a third are coming out and dropping out of school before they finish high school. Another third practically are, you know, when they come out, they got to go take remedial courses, and they don't finish college. We've got a crisis in K-12 that has been chronic, that we keep fooling around with, we keep talking about it, but we haven't solved it. And it's part and parcel of a growing cultural problem. When we came out of school in the 60s, Pat Moynihan was trying to warn us of the danger of the disintegration of black families. Remember how much of a price he paid for that when he raised that issue? But what he said, which was so prescient, was if we don't deal with it now with the black families, we're going to see the same thing with white families. And that's exactly what we are seeing today. More than half the children born to this country, the women under 30 years of age, are born out of wedlock. More than half. And a child born out of wedlock is four times more likely to be in poverty, much more likely to have obesity, much more likely to have drug problems, much less likely to finish college. And we shouldn't blame the moms. These moms are, a lot of them, heroic, single moms raising kids like this. We got to get men in this country to step up, man up, and take responsibility for these children. And finally, David's right. We've got a broken down political system. We all know that. Now, what are our responsibilities in all of this? I would just suggest we have two. One is, as a generation, we still have work to do. We can, you know, this is not time to clip coupons or go play golf. We've got other things to do as well. And we really have a moral responsibility, in my judgment, as a generation, to do what we can to solve some of these problems we're leaving to the next generation, to our kids and our grandkids. And the second thing we need to do is support the young people that are coming. Because I will tell you this, and David knows this better than anybody in this room, a lot of the kids who are coming through college now are the best we have seen in a long, long time. They remind me so much of the World War II generation. This is a generation that wants to give back, that cares, and we can do a lot for them. Here at Yale, here at Yale, 18% of the kids are volunteering for Teach for America. More kids want to go out and teach in the eighth grade in the Bronx than go to Wall Street and make money. 18%. At Harvard, it's about the same thing. The Ivy League is heavy. But it's not just the Ivy League. I bet you got a lot of kids at the University of Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
It's probably one of the proudest things you have.
Absolutely.
The kids that get in to Teach for America. And 60% of these kids stay involved in public education reform. They go start charter schools. You know, the KIPP program is the best charter school program in the country.
Yeah.
That's coming out of these kind of young people who really want to be out there, but they need help. They need scholarship help. They need encouragement. They need training help. They need all these things because they're going to turn the system around. And I'll tell you, the other group that's coming out is these young military veterans. We've got military veterans coming out right now who will knock your socks off. And it's the silver lining out of 12 years of these wars. And that is that people are coming back out of Iraq and Afghanistan are wonderful. They're terrific leaders. And what we need to do is make sure they get jobs and they get a chance to start in life, get them into graduate programs. I bet you've got a lot of veterans on the Oklahoma campus now.
Special scholarships.
Special scholarships. The Yellow Ribbon program.
Coming back program.
Yeah, exactly. And from my point of view, we have the age and the wisdom, and sometimes some people here have deep pockets. We need to work with this younger generation because help is on the way. And that, to me, is the most encouraging thing going on in the country. Thank you.
A little bit of my background. I spent 40 years in the media doing political analysis, radio and television in Boston, 22 years with the ABC affiliate there. And I still do a talk show on one of the major radio stations in Boston. One thing that was interesting, it struck me, is we had no discussion beforehand as to what direction of travel. So it's interesting to have diverse points of view. When I was preparing for the panel, I was asking people what they thought were the top two issues facing the country. And it was interesting to get the response. In a way, it was a reflection of that each person is the center of his own universe. So, for example, I asked a woman lawyer, successful lawyer in her mid-40s, that question, and she said, the high cost of education and drugs. And that's because she had one child just entering college, another one just finishing high school. And indeed, we've had some conversation here about education. Retrospectively, our last year here at Yale cost us about $2,000. This academic year at Yale, $53,400. The CPI, by the way, is about 7.5, so you can see how much education has gone up. Although, interestingly enough, there was a poll just released today by Rasmussen that said only 34% of the people thought that increasing money spent on education will enhance student performance. And in the same poll, different question, they asked, are you getting a good return on our investment in public education? 13% said yes, 68% said no. So there's no inclination here in terms of the public to spend more on education. Other people mentioned health care, those people who are beyond having to worry about kids in school. And of course, Obamacare is one of the major challenges facing us. But the way I thought, if I had to answer that question, it comes from a different angle. My greatest concern is the power and scope of government, the intrusion into our daily lives, and the enormous amount of regulation growing by the day that is imposed on everybody. I'm glad I get some sympathy for that even here. To give you an idea, John Stossel wrote a column, that Obamacare legislation, which is being implemented now, was originally 906 pages, it's now 2,000 pages. There are 20,000 pages of regulations. It's a stack 7 feet high, growing daily. Before Obamacare came in, we had 16,000 different codes for ailments that we might have. Now, there will be more than 100,000. Give you an example. If you're injured at a chicken coop, that's a Y9272. I was at a lecture earlier at an art gallery. Had I fallen, that's a Y92250. There are three different codes for walking into a lamppost, depending on how often you've walked into lampposts. And it goes on. It gives you an idea of the strangulation that we have. Walk into a doctor's office. The doctor now, last time I saw him, started asking me questions he had never asked before. He said, I'm going to give you three numbers, and then I'm going to ask you to repeat them later. I said, why are you asking me that? Well, we have to do that. So we now have the government intruding into the relationship between ourselves and our doctors. And to make matters worse, perhaps, as you know, the oversight, the enforcement for this new law is the Internal Revenue Service. And you've probably been following what has happened with the IRS. I didn't want to believe, I used to hear rumors to this effect, that the IRS would target people on the basis of politics. Yes, I heard Nixonian problems that way, but that's a half century ago. And I was appalled to find that the IRS on its own initiative would single out people and ask them questions, for example, do you intend to run for office ever? What prayers do you say? This is inappropriate for the tax collecting agency. The woman who was in charge, Sarah Ingram, has now been promoted. She's going to be the one in charge of the enforcement by the IRS of Obamacare. Lois Lerner, who was below her, supervisor of this division, goes before Congress, first says she did nothing wrong, she broke no law, and then she invokes the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment means you don't have to say something that's going to incriminate yourself. But if you've done nothing wrong, what will you be concerned about incrimination? To the best of my knowledge, to this day, we don't even know the names of the people who perpetrated this. Stephen Miller, the outgoing commissioner of the IRS, when asked that question, said, I don't have any names. Lois Lerner, by the way, has been put on administrative leave with pay at $177,000 a year. Now, when we see these kinds of things going on, and this is what we've found out about, Lord knows what we haven't found out about. The IRS scandal is unfolding even as we speak. But the regulatory impact, these kinds of intrusions and these kinds of restrictions are going on in all the various agencies. It was just revealed over the last couple of days that the Department of Health and Human Services has been soliciting voluntary contributions from companies that it is going to regulate to help support the implementation of Obamacare. Now, the word voluntary has an interesting meaning here. This is the kind of thing where someone comes into your shop and says, you got a nice store here. It would be a shame if something happened to it. We sell protection. It's voluntary. When the government is coming in and, in effect, threatening the people that it regulates to contribute or else, we have gone too far. It was mentioned earlier about the national debt, $16 trillion. It is larger than our economy. It passed it a few months ago. Enormous amount of money, and yet we add to the deficit every year. So my overarching concern is, while we still can, I would like to see if we can scale back the power, the authority, the centralization of force that government has. It's not in the best interest of this country, and it certainly is not what this country was all about in terms of the founding principles by our founding fathers when we were trying to get away from the centralized tyranny. Okay, that's... Now I'll open it up to... Any panelists want to respond, or should we just open it up to the...
We just have only about 20 minutes, they say, before the next group moves in
about,
on us. So
about 25 minutes,
hear
so
what,
we got
what
to.
All of you have to say.
Now, there are two men with microphones, so guys, if you can find the people with their hands up, bring the microphone over.
As one of the old white guys, Dave, are you encouraged by the 20 women in the Senate? My feeling is the solution to most of our problems will be solved by a five-letter word, women.
Which Dave we're talking to? I think we both think that's a good idea.
I don't know. I don't know which Dave's going to feel that, but I suspect we're going to come down in the same place. And that is, it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. I think that the perspectives are needed. I frankly think that the candor and the willingness to clean house, which is often wanting among us in the so-called oh boy networks, I think it's a very good thing. I think it's a very positive thing. I think more important than that, is will they not only cooperate with each other, but will they cooperate across the aisle? I think the most serious, and as I sit here listening to all of our views, the most serious problem in the country is polarization and the breakdown of community into fragments that don't live together, talk together often enough. We've sorted ourselves out in groups. We stay in these groups. We don't work across the aisle. We have no, there's nothing in our political system today that encourages us to work together. So to me, even more important than whether there are women there, which I think is very positive, is will they help be a force in, again, helping that institution function? And I think we somehow learned the genie's out of the bottle. Can we ever get it back in? Think what kind of health care bill we could have written. If they'd sat down at the White House before anything was ever released, we wouldn't have the kind of, as I say, horrible result that we've had. And Democrats and Republicans got together around the table and said, what are the things we can agree upon first? And you know, about 60% of this bill, polls of Congress showed they could agree on it. If you lose your job, should you lose your health insurance? No, it ought to be portable of some kind. Should you have no health insurance if you don't have a pre-existing condition? No. There were a lot of things they could have agreed upon. And if they'd walked out of there, 8 or 10 Democratic and 8 or 10 Republican leaders with the president said, here's a bipartisan proposal. All of us can agree on these fundamentals. Let's pass it first and get it done, and then we can come back and work on it later. I think women tend to have that kind of approach to issues, perhaps sometimes even better than men. So I think it's a positive. I'll see if David wants to alienate the half the audience.
The research is incomplete right now, but I think there's a fair amount of evidence that women make excellent leaders. We have all sorts of universities that have been run by women in recent years who have been very, very successful. What we know is that whether by DNA or by acculturation, women are more collaborative, for example, than men. And leadership increasingly is about collaboration, being able to work across, beyond your group, that they're more empathic. Certainly, we know that when a certain number of women join a corporate board, the conversation in the board changes, the agenda changes. And do all women succeed? No. Carly Fiorina, was held up and I think almost pilloried because she was so prominent there for a while, and when she went down, she paid a big price. But the world in the last few years here in the United States has also been celebrating Margaret Thatcher. And we know that women can be very principled, very strong, but I would argue, yes, they can be more collaborative. And what the hell, we guys haven't made a great hash, made a good deal of it. Let's try it.
I would just add, whether it's women or men, neither gender even read the health care bill before they voted on it. Next question.
I have two points. Stand up. Okay, I'll stand up. One is related to prisons, and the other is just suggestions about what to do. And I think one of the striking things that seems to be occurring in states is as the money dries up for education, it increases in building more prisons, and you have this bigger governmental investment in putting people in prison than getting them educated. And I'd be interested in your comments on that. And David, you said we shouldn't clip coupons and other things. What would you suggest are good things to consider to do after today?
I don't know which one's which. Anybody want to comment on that first?
About the prisons.
Well, certainly, you're right. I mean, you do see exactly. There's a direct line almost in Poland. I mean, in the amount you spend on prisons and the amount you spend on education. We always said we need to spend more money on the highways so we could get the people to the prisons faster after they drop out of the schools. I guess that would show real priorities in our society. But I think that's really important. The other thing, when you do get people in prison, one of the things, this sounds sort of strange to say, but educate them. One of the things that I tried to work on very hard, we found that many of the people in prison had not finished high school, et cetera. So we had huge behind bars educational programs. When I was governor, I used to go to the commencement ceremony, so to speak. It was a very interesting thing because if you'd closed your eyes and not know where you were, these looked like young people who were, you'd see at a college or university or a high school or someplace else that just needed to move in another direction. But I think that that's, That's absolutely true. We need to do that. The other thing we need to do is probably not think that prison is a solution to so many problems. It's not going to break addiction. It's not going to break a lot of other problems. So if we can find ways to decriminalize and other alternatives to put people to work in the community, have them work on public works projects, have them do other things, and then make sure you put them out in work release. So that's always a problem I had was, where do I put the work release center? Where I put the inmates, where I try to get them out into private sector jobs for 6 months so they don't get dropped off the prison with a $20 bus ticket, no job, nothing to go back to, no stability. So we tried to do that. But again, it breaks my heart when I see us fail to give the opportunities we need to a lot of talent. There is so much talent potential out there. And this, again, goes back to our generation. I just thought, what if every one of us took an at-risk child, and we can find out who the at-risk children are through our school system, or formed an organization in our communities. We're trying to do this now in Oklahoma. We have so many people early retiring with so much capability. They're really the grandparent age of the young people that are at risk. If every one of us would just invest our lives in one at-risk child in our school systems, it would absolutely transform the country to have them have somebody who pays attention to it. I see it in our university. We've gone from 80 of our students who are big brothers and big sisters to 2,000 of our students who are now big brothers and big sisters. You would not believe the impact that they're having on these children's lives. And I agree with what David said, helps on the way, because the percentage of the young people today that want to volunteer and make a difference and give back while they're still in school. It's how I didn't know how to, I didn't raise my hand in your earlier question. Because if I look at so many of the indicators, do I think we're going to pass on a greater, is our country going to be greater in the future? Maybe we're not passing it on. I think our country's going to be greater in the future, though. And I think so because these kids. Mm-hmm. I think that this generation of students, if they can get past the dropout, get past the problems they get into, they're absolutely phenomenal. So I think there's a lot of reason for hope about the country in that regard.
Yeah, let me just, I agree with David on the prison thing. We ought to distinguish between people who commit violent crimes. We ought to be tough as hell on them and really examine the number of people we're putting away for nonviolent. We are, the black male population in this country in urban areas is devastated by what's been happening in the interplay with the prison system.
David, you know this, but half of every young male that you see on the streets of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, has been in prison before age 21. Yeah. Half.
Yeah, and most of them for nonviolent.
For nonviolent offenses.
That's what we ought to look at. But I do think, I think David's right, there are a lot of things we can do as individuals that you can find. There are any number of social entrepreneurs today, for example, who have startups that are in the early stages. And they either may need help getting off the ground, but they especially need help at the second stage financing. They need, they need people to come in and help manage, help run it. These national organizations all have regional, now increasingly have regional organizations. They need local boards. They need citizens from the local community to be involved. I think there is actually a lot. And one of my hopes is that Yale will do something that Harvard has been experimenting with. It's actually gotten off the ground. We're probably a little old for it, but Harvard's now started a program that I'm very involved with. The business school took the lead on it, but it's for universities traditionally help people either at the beginning of their careers or worked with them in their mid-careers coming back for executive education. We've started the program for people at the end of their first career to come back to school and spend a year at Harvard in a variety of different programs. We've got about 70 people now, mostly self-financing. And that they take a year out, and they're basically leaving corporate life, and they're moving into the nonprofit sector, and they want to know how to make a big difference. And they want to study best practice and all that sort of thing. And they essentially take a sabbatical, and they go out refreshed, ready to roll. And it's turning out to be a very successful program. And I bet other schools will start doing that.
I just want to add one point, because I guess I start out talking about the importance of culture and values. There was an interesting book written by Thomas Sowell, who's a black economist at the Hoover Institution, called Black Rednecks and White Liberals. And his point was that black culture, as celebrated by the press, is really a white culture that came from Britain with the Scots-Irish immigrants. They were called rednecks or crackers, but because blacks who lived in the South lived with this white culture for centuries, they adopted this culture. Now, over time, according to Sowell, most blacks, or many blacks, I should say, and whites, abandoned this culture because it was dysfunctional in America, because this idea of fighting authority, of being manly and macho and not knuckling under, basically, was not really the way to get ahead. The white liberals of the title comes because, in Sowell's opinion, over the last 50 years since the 1960s, whites have glorified black culture. The people who maintain this culture in the black community were the poor, those in the ghettos. And the white liberals of the title celebrated this culture as authentic and glorified it. And because of that, in Sowell's opinion, blacks never really abandoned that culture, and they're dysfunctional today. If you look at the data that Charles Murray had mentioned in his book, he looked only at whites to avoid charges of racism. But at the end of the book, he expands it to all races. And although whites and other races were very similar in both the blue, or I should say the working class and the upper middle class in their embrace of culture, in the black area, excuse me, in the working class area, there was one notable difference between whites and blacks, which was the rate of incarceration. The arrest rates were very similar, but the incarceration rates for blacks were much higher. I don't know if Sowell's theory holds up, but he actually holds the liberal, white liberal glorification of black culture as a major culprit. I just thought I'd throw that as a different perspective.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
David Boren. I want to pick up on a point that you made about the polarization, political polarization of both parties, and the really effective gerrymandering that we now have of every congressional district in the country. I think it's actually the single most serious problem confronting at least the functioning of government, because government, and certainly the Congress, is now almost totally paralyzed between the, as you put it, the hard left and the hard right. Is there a political solution? Is there perhaps a constitutional solution to this problem? Because it seems to me without it, government is condemned almost permanently to paralysis.
Well, I think you're right. And if you add to it also the whole problem, which we haven't mentioned, of campaign finance reform, by the way, and since the Ford-Carter election, and this is true relatively of congressional races as well, Ford-Carter election, the two of them together spent an enormous, we were shocked, $60 million was spent this year, of course, well over $6 billion, and the same thing's reflected in congressional races. So if you put together a safe district, safe for one party or the other, and you then, the only way to get elected is to appeal to the more extreme element in that political party, not to cooperate across the aisle, you'll get killed for that. You know, you look at what happened to Dick Lugar, or you look at other examples around the country of what happens. So we do have to try to figure out a way. And I think we're really down to the fact that we have to make some basic constitutional reforms in this country. One of them is in how you would approach it. I've been having our law school try to come up with ideas for me. We have an institute on the American Constitution, by the way, at OU, where we take up current constitutional issues. Unfortunately, there are only five of us in the country, and also teach our constitutional heritage. Do you know that only 7% of universities in the country now require a single course in American history or American government to graduate? Only 7% of universities. So no wonder we're not learning our own history. We don't understand our own constitution. But perhaps we could require, one approach might be to require that each state is not redistricted by the state legislature, it is redistricted by a nonpartisan, and it has to be demonstratively nonpartisan, so that every district in the state has to be roughly reflective of the same proportion of, let's say, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents in that state. There's some trials going on. California has sort of been trying a certain approach at this, but I think we're going to have to do it. And it'll have to be a constitutional amendment, which means it has to be a grassroots movement, because this isn't the kind of thing that Congress is going to undo their own safe districts. When I was in the Senate, I remember Howard Baker said to me, he said there are about 30 of us that, as he put it, play between the 40-yard line, and we make the difference, and we make things happen. That 30 or so is maybe now 4, 5, 6 at the most that are there. The center has disappeared from American politics, and it's part of it's the way we fund campaigns, part of it's the way we draw districts. And I even this year, I participated in something, some of you may have seen it, called Americans Elect. We had the idea, we got on the ballot in over 40 states. We would have been in all 50 states until we hit a snag. But the idea was that the system, the two-party system, is so poorly serving, both parties, so poorly serving the country, more interested in fighting with each other than in getting something done, that we need an electric shock, so to speak, to the system, and we should get a Democrat and a Republican to run together for president and vice president. They wouldn't be a third party. They would be a fusion ticket, calling for unity of the two parties and try to run together for president and vice president. I circulated petitions in Oklahoma. We got 300,000. California had over 1.5 million signed the signatures, put on the ballot. Then one thing happened. Old saying in politics, you can't beat someone. I even resigned from the President's Intelligence Advisory Board as co-chairman from it because I said, told the President I thought I didn't want to be an embarrassment if I was out advocating this. He said, well, it is a little embarrassing that you seem to be think there might be a better alternative to me. But he was nice enough to refuse my resignation. But the thing is, what happened in the end was we had no candidate. We were in a room in Washington with about a dozen, and everyone on this panel would have been able to have named all these people. Half of them were people of stature in the Republican Party. Half of them were people of real stature and known in the Democratic Party. They all said they were willing to seriously consider being one of these candidates and forming a fusion ticket. Within 3 weeks of it, it all fell apart. One by one by one, every candidate, potential candidate, for some reason or another, backed out. But I don't know. I'm very frustrated, as you can tell, and I think that at some point we may need to do something as extreme and have an electric shock treatment of some kind that elect a president and a Democrat, it's not really either the Republican or Democratic nominee. And instead of a third party, I'm afraid of that. Maybe it's a fusion ticket of people from both sides who are willing to work together. But constitutional amendment's going to be required.
There's another aspect to this also, and that is that you get people who spend their entire lives in the Congress. Now, we have in Massachusetts a Senate contest. The Democratic nominee has been in Congress for 37 years. When you talk about term limits, which is frequently brought up and supported by the public, this takes a constitutional amendment that Dave was referring to. That requires a vote of 2/3 of each of the houses of Congress, does not require the president's signature, but does require ratification by 3/4 of the legislatures. What are the chances that the politicians who are entrenched and incumbents are going to vote themselves out of office and vote for this amendment? I think it would be great if we had some redistricting. You know, in Massachusetts, we've got an entire congressional and Senate delegation that is Democrat. And it is true that most of the people in Massachusetts are Democrat, but in any contested statewide race, the Republicans will get 40% plus of the vote. Now, 40% in politics, as you know, is enough to get no representation at all. So they're permanently disenfranchised. I've often speculated that maybe what we need is some kind of antitrust legislation. After all, if a company had that much power, we'd be talking about bringing it up. Maybe there ought to be some kind of antitrust application so that the power is divided more equitably among the people so they can be represented even in a liberal state like Massachusetts. There are some of us who would like to have an opportunity to have a few words with someone on our side.
Yeah, coming from the west of the Mississippi, I'd like to have an opportunity to say something. And because you can't hear? Okay, now, good. Yeah, I know, having been in Boston, I understand that that's the cultural center of the country as well as the universe. But there's been a very interesting experience in Arizona where a woman who graduated from the School of Journalism at Yale actually developed a redistricting program to meet, it's the only one in the country that met the three, I think there's three nationally stated criteria for redistricting from the Department of Justice, if I'm correct. And this is the only one in the country that met that. And when so she redistricted that way, and then the legislature brought suit against her. And so the legislature can obviously nullify it. And Arizona has a super qualified legislature where 20% of its members are college graduates. There was Molly Ivins was a 6 foot tall Texas columnist who said when the Texas legislature was in session, all the village idiots were out of town.
By the way, percentage of college graduates in state legislatures across the country in the last 10 years has fallen precipitously.
I wanted to add one perspective on this issue of difficulty with government. When Alexis de Tocqueville came to this country in 1835 and wrote Democracy in America, he noted that the federal government was involved almost entirely with international or foreign affairs issues, and that the domestic policy was really in the hands of the states. I think there is an argument to be made that one of the reasons why it's so difficult to reach consensus in Washington at the federal level is because the government is involved in too many things. For example, if you look at the so-called immigration reform bill, I mean, there are so many issues that it touches on. For example, Obamacare, there's an issue as to whether new immigrants or those who are regularized should be subject to Obamacare. Strangely enough, some of the unions were against the idea that immigrants, these new citizens, should be exempt from Obamacare, which was a budgetary thing, because Obamacare put costly mandates on employers, and if these new regularized residents were excused from Obamacare, employers would prefer to hire the newly documented immigrants. The issues are so complex because there are so many issues that the federal government gets involved with that my opinion is that that's why it's hard to agree, because it's so important to win the political battle. The stakes are so high. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't want to leave this conversation, though, with us feeling completely bleak politically. There are people coming into politics now in the U.S. Senate since David left, because there was a real emptying out, and David represented part of that. It was a terrible, terrible blow to the Senate. But there are people now, like Mark Warner from Virginia, as a Democrat, who's come in, I think is very constructive. Or Rob Portman, a Republican from Ohio. Or Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, another Republican. Angus King has come in from Maine as an independent. And he's a strikingly interesting individual. His hero in life is someone we're remembering this year, Joshua Chamberlain, from Little Round Top. There are some really, really interesting people starting to come. And again, I come back to some of these military veterans. Some of the military veterans who are thinking about running. Have you met Eric Greitens? Have you gotten to know Eric? He's the kind of young man I think is going to be in the Senate soon. He's just a remarkably different people who are rejecting and hate the old politics as much as any of us here in this room, the politics we're seeing right now.
The fierce Yale staffer in the back has signaled that we have time for one more question and brief answer. So,
thank you, gentlemen, for looking at these big picture issues, and certainly they're difficult to work with. But you haven't addressed things that seem most important to me. I'm from the West Coast and probably extremist, but I don't like the Republicrats.
You don't like
them? What it means is neither side offers me what I'm looking for in leadership. Mm-hmm. You heard, I think, David Warren, your comment that we went from 80% support of our government to about 9% or something in the current review, I think is a serious problem. We have the best government money can buy. In this last crisis.
Or rent.
Excuse me, David?
Or rent.
Or rent. In the last financial crisis, nobody basically went to jail except the guy that admitted he did it Madoff. In the last financial crisis, over 1,000 savings and loan executives went to jail. We put 2 billion bullets into the Homeland Security. What for? Why are we building prisons for ourselves? I fear that the government is out to control itself, maintain its power, and oppress the people. The taking away of personal liberties in the Guantanamo, in the Patriot Act, in the things that are talked about peripherally in the medical coverage of Obamacare, don't get to the depth of my concern of where our country is going. I feel it's going much more toward what Hitler Germany did by centralized control and takeover of power. I want a government half as big as it is. There's nobody that supports that in a way they'll have a political support that I can join up with. I'd like your comments.
Anybody want to comment or just leave it there?
He was talking about NGO kinds of issues are not understanding the issues of what I think is outward. It isn't a laughing matter for me.
No, I think it's not a laughing matter. And I think you're expressing the very kind of frustration that shows itself in this disconnect between people and the government, in the sense that we have control over it and that it can represent us, and that is a very, very dangerous thing for the future of the country. And we cannot ignore some of these fundamental constitutional. Do we think people are going to change if we don't do something about campaign finance reform? I've lived through the terror of wondering if somebody that got one check now under Citizens United could, you know, put $10 million against me in a race if I were still in. My son worried about it. He quit. These are real serious problems. The takeover, you know, someone just wrote a book, former Congressman Mickey Edwards said, how can we teach Democrats and Republicans to become Americans? A pretty good question. And that's the reason I come back to. We can't sit here and ignore these things. We can't ignore some of the fundamental, even constitutional amendments and other things that need to be done. And that's the reason why I still remain convinced that we may have to do something that shocks the whole system in a way that will sort of restart the process. And if you had a vice president and a president from different parties who weren't trying to score political points but solve problems, and I do think things work better as you return more of the responsibility back to the local level, maybe we can do something. But we cannot. The country is drifting in a terrible direction, and if we do nothing, and we can do something, and I go back to David, help's on the way. These young people are thinking through these problems in a good way, and they want to give themselves. They're going to come into the system. They're going to change the system. I'd like to take this generation I work with at the university, and I'd love to see them put in charge of the country within the next 5 to 10 years. The sooner, the better.
My thanks to my fellow panelists, and thank you all for coming.
That was fun. Good job. Thank you.